Again, in this session, we're going to start with a Vipassana meditation. So again, we're going to scan through the body, observing the sensations and observing whether they're stable or changing moment by moment. So still again, the impermanence to check, see if everything in the body is impermanent. But on top of that, this time, we're going to look directly to see if anything we see in the body is the self, me. Often, particularly when we're threatened or something, there seems to be a me, particularly somewhere here, you know, I'm being threatened. And often we have a sense that somewhere here is a me, the me that's being threatened. We sort of feel that. So, therefore, in this practice of scanning, again, just checking the sensations, seeing if they're rising, passing, or there's some stability. And at the same time, then, see if anything that you observe in the body is the self. Is that the self? Is that the me? Or is that something that I'm observing? It's an object. Is it the subject, or is it just an object? So check. So we'll do that check as well in this meditation. Okay? And then we'll go back into the text after the meditation. Okay, so find a nice comfortable posture. Keeping the back nice and straight and allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. letting go of any thoughts of the past or the future, allowing the mind to come into the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Again, we can begin our Vipassana practice, applying mindfulness to the body, scanning the body from head to toe, looking at the reality of the body, noticing sensations, whether they're stable or simply arising and passing. And also seeing if there's anything within the body that's the self, that's the me. Scanning in your own pace. Covering every part of the body. anybody find the self, the me? I'm still looking, so if someone finds it, please let me know where it is. Yeah.
When I focus on the situation on my head, I usually get, I have a pleasant sensation. It happens for several times. So maybe that's myself, no?
Again, in this practice, we are looking directly with bare attention. So when we ask these questions, is that the self? We're not then answering those questions intellectually. Because often intellectually, we all have some idea, or most of us have an idea who the self is based on our reading and our backgrounds. So often, you know, intellectually, in Buddhism, you know, we talk about the subtle mental continuum. So often people read about that and they go, oh yeah, that's the self. Because I learned that. It's a subtle mental continuum. So then when we do these sorts of meditations, asking to look for the self, then instead of looking directly, people go, yeah, yeah, me, that's the subtle mental continuum. Or maybe, oh, I'm a subtle energy field. You know, that's me, because that's what I sort of learned or believe in. And so then always people come up with an answer based on their intellectual beliefs. But the thing is that we are looking directly, experientially, for the me that we relate to experientially. You know, when we're getting angry at someone, the me that's getting angry, are we relating to a subtle energy field? Are we relating to the subtle mental continuum as the me that's getting angry? I don't think so. No. So with this and other types of meditations which are coming in the retreat a little bit later, in terms of when we're looking for the me, the self, then we need to look directly and not turn it into an intellectual exercise. Because if we turn it into an intellectual exercise, I'm sure we'll all come up with some sort of answer based on our beliefs or background as to who the me is. But again, our behaviour is not driven by our intellectual beliefs. Our behaviour is driven by instinctive habit. And instinctively we're grasping onto me. And it's that me that we're instinctively, experientially grasping onto. That's what we're looking for. Is that somewhere in the body? So this is very important. Okay. Let's go back into the text. So we're looking again at the preparation for the shamatha practice. And we're looking at the preparation at the beginning of a session in terms of these six preparations. And we left off at point four, visualizing the merit field. So we've set ourselves up, we've sat down, we've set a good motivation, bodhicitta hopefully. And now this fourth point is visualize this merit field, which is to, the merit field is again the field with which respect to we're going to do the next step. And so here we can be very simple as a beginner. We could have just simply visualize our teacher in front of us. Or even if we don't have a teacher, we can visualize someone who we have a lot of high respect for, someone like Dalai Lama or someone like this. We can visualize that. Or the historical Buddha if we have some connection. And then we do step five. And step five here is this, what's called the seven limb prayer. Sorry?
For the fourth point.
So visualize. So remember, if we set up an altar here,
yes.
We could, I mean, the Tibetan tradition often with the altar is to have these offerings, seven or eight water bowls, and then often you'll find symbolizing body, speech, and mind of a Buddha. You'll have a statue of a Buddha, which is the body. You'll have a stupa, which is symbolizing the mind of the Buddha. And on the other side, you'll have a text symbolizing the speech of the Buddha. So that's the sort of traditional. But also, you'll maybe sometimes find on an altar or
on the as a like a tanka, a picture behind the altar, you may have like the Buddha, a tanka of the Buddha in the middle, and then on one side you'll have maybe a tanka drawing of Manjushri, the with the sword. This is symbolizing wisdom. And then on the other side, often you'll maybe have a tanka of Chenrezig, the Buddha of compassion, or sometimes Maitreya, the future Buddha, symbolizing the method side. So often you'll have this as tankas or pictures behind the altar, symbolizing the Buddha, and then method and wisdom, wisdom and compassion. This is also possible. So here the seven in prayer, we've got this in your prayers for meditation. So let's have a look in the prayers of meditation. So again, at the beginning of the meditation, we go for refuge, generate bodhicitta, the positive motivation. And here we preceded that with the four thoughts to briefly reflect on these four points so that when we go for refuge and generate bodhicitta, they won't be words from our mouth. And then actually in these prayers for meditation, just after it, you see the four immeasurables. So that's also related to the bodhicitta. So we could also go through those four lines and reflect on those four points to develop this loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. So that would also be very helpful. So that's quite traditional to have that. And then we have this seven-limb prayer here. And so that's what we do now with respect to the merit field, whoever we've visualized in front of us. So let's keep it simple and say we've visualized our teacher or some holy person, Dalai Lama, in front of us. And then we go through the seven-limb prayer. And again, the seven-limb prayer has a particular purpose. So this is all, of course, preparing ourselves for meditation. To prepare ourselves for meditation at this stage means to increase the positive state of mind and to decrease any negativity in the mind. And so these points have one of those functions. So the first point we see here is, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. So here we are sort of mentally bowing down to whoever we've visualized in front of us. And so this is particularly good for subduing pride. You know, often we have this sort of arrogant pride that, you know, I'm someone special, I'm a great practitioner or so forth. So if at the beginning of the meditation we do this mentally sort of bowing down to this person, and we're not really bowing down to the person, we're more bowing down to their qualities. You know, we're sort of bowing down to the qualities that they possess, the ones that we would like to strive for. So that gives us really a sense of humility and not this sort of arrogant pride that I'm really already very good. And there's a nice expression, I'm not sure if it comes, I think it might be coming from Tibetan Buddhism, but it's the harvest of good qualities does not grow on the rocky peaks of pride. You know, the harvest is in the low fertile valleys, meaning in the low fertile valleys of humility. So by doing this here, that really helps us to be more humble and to avoid this arrogant sort of state of mind. Then the second point, I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. So often here in the Tibetan tradition, sometimes it involves some very elaborate visualization. You like imagine the whole universe full of jewels or flowers or something, and then you offer this. So again, this offering is to help us to develop generosity, to help us overcome this state of miserliness. But here, I think what can be very helpful in a practical way in terms of offering is to offer our practice to the teacher. The practice that we're about to do is to offer that to them. I think that can be a very heartfelt and inspiring thing to do. The third point, I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time. So this serves the function of purifying our mind of negativity. And of course, in Buddhism, we often talk about these four opponent powers.
a way of purifying the mind of negativities. So this is really what we're doing here, is we're openly declaring any negative actions we've done to, for example, our teacher. And then also we can develop some sincere regret for having done those negative actions. So by doing this step, we're really starting to purify our mind of negative habits and negative behaviour by openly declaring them and regretting them and letting them go. Then the fourth step, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. So here, this is like this empathetic joy, one of the four immeasurables, is a rejoicing in the virtues of ourselves and others. So here, we can then rejoice in all the virtuous activities of all the holy beings and ordinary beings in others. So here again, we can be very practical. If we've sort of seen recently someone who's really done something virtuous, then just bring that to mind and rejoice in that. And I think also very important here is to rejoice about good things that we do. Because often we're always focusing on ourselves in the negative, you know, bad me, poor me, I'm hopeless, I'm useless, and so forth. So here I think it can be very helpful to bring to mind something that we have done just maybe in the last day, and to rejoice in that, you know. And so if you're doing a retreat, of course you can rejoice about following, doing the retreat and trying to meditate and understand all these things. So I think this is also very helpful here, is to also to rejoice about any good things that you've done. And then the next two sort of go together. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. So here we are requesting, for example, if we visualized our teacher, requesting them to continue to guide us. So this request, and requesting them to stay in our lives as well. So these sorts of requests can be very powerful. You know, often this is sort of, it's called a prayer. And so often when people come into Buddhism from a Christian background, they come in and they say, oh no, all those prayers again. I was trying to get away from all those prayers, you know. Now I'm doing all these prayers again. So here we need to understand what we're talking about here in terms of prayer. So a prayer here is making an aspiration, a wish, for our teacher to continue to teach us and to continue to stay in our life. And this prayer, if we do it in a heartfelt way, really creates strong imprints in our mind for us to experience that actually happening. You know, the great modern day philosopher, William James, says, what we attend to becomes our reality. So if we really are making sincere aspirations to receive teachings and for our teacher to continue to stay in our life, that will create strong imprints that can ripen in that way. So this is something we shouldn't underestimate. You know, often we have this saying, or we hear this, you know, when you're ready, the teacher will appear. You know, we often hear this. So we have this idea that sort of, you know, we'll be at home and then there'll be a knock on the door, and we'll open the door and there'll be a person with a big halo around their head saying, I'm here to teach you. I think this is not going to happen. So if we really want a teacher, or if we have a teacher and we want that teacher to really stay in our life and guide us, this is what we need to do. Is we really need to make these prayers in terms of these aspirations to meet with teachers and to have requesting them to continue to teach us. In fact, what you often find is in the Tibetan tradition that a teacher will not just teach. Even if you request them, they'll say no. The tradition is that you have to ask them at least three times. And that's a sign that you're really sincere, that you really want them to teach, and that you're not just going, oh, can you teach me? You know. So I think from our side, if we really can make those sincere prayers, those sincere aspirations to meet with a teacher and to be, continue to be guided by our teacher if we have one, then that's going to really be very helpful in meeting teachers and to continue to have teachers guiding us in our life. So that's these two points here. And then finally, then the dedication. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the great enlightenment. So whenever we engage in any virtuous activity, particularly, you know, in the Lojong teachings that I briefly mentioned, they often there's one little pithy saying that says, there are two things which are important, one at the beginning and one at the end. Meaning, what's important at the beginning is to set the good motivation, refuge bodhicitta if possible, and what's good at the end is to dedicate whatever we've done, the meditation or any virtuous activity, towards the goal, towards, particularly here in Mahayana, the goal of enlightenment. So that will direct that positive virtue towards that, in that direction. So this is the seven limb prayer, and again, to do this at the beginning of a meditation, but unfortunately what often happens is, again, people have, you know, a bit of paper like this, and then they get to the seven limb prayer and they go, okay, done. And then, of course, nothing happens. So, again, we really need to be careful to avoid turning this into a mechanical, ritualistic thing. And really it's important to understand what each of those points, the significance of them, and then whether or not we actually use those exact words or whether we do something in our own way, in a heartfelt way, you know, then that's what's important. It's not so important that we have to recite exactly those words, but it's what's behind them that's important. So again, this seven limb prayer is step five, and then step six. Oh, before I go to step six, any questions about any of those seven limb prayers, any of those points? Okay. Step six then. Is to make requests. And we see that in the next verse here, this four-line request. And we see that in your in the text. It says, meditate on the profound path of Guru Yoga, which includes step four and five and often a lot of other things as well. And then it says, and then after making hundreds of very strong fervent requests, dissolve the Guru into yourself. So the request, an example, is this four-line verse here in your prayers for meditation. And this is a very general request. Please bless me to cease all deluded minds immediately, from disrespect for the gurus up to the subtle dualistic conception. Please bless me to generate all unmistaken minds instantly, from respect for the gurus to the realization of emptiness. So this is, any of you who have studied the Lam Rim, when it says from here to here, it's talking about all, the whole spiritual path. Because the first topic is relying on a teacher, and the final topic in the Lam Rim is the wisdom of emptiness. So here this verse is basically saying, please help me to realize all the stages of the path. And then it says, please bless me to completely pacify all outer and inner obstacles. So again, here, I think it can be very helpful to use this as a basis, but then to really do it in a very heartfelt way. And in a practical way, I think here, at the beginning of a meditation, it can also be very helpful to make a request for our teacher to bless us, to help us to do whatever the practice we're about to do. You know, if we're going to do a shamatha practice, then please bless me to be able to practice shamatha well, or something like this. And then it says here to dissolve the guru into yourself. And so often here then when we visualize the merit field, again maybe we've visualized just the teacher. Or if we've done it more elaborate, often we have the teacher in the middle. So if we have the teacher and then a lot of other lineage masters and so forth, we can dissolve them into the teacher or the guru. And then we can imagine they come to the top of our head and then we dissolve them into us. And often we imagine them dissolving into our heart. And sometimes you'll see in Tantra, you imagine them sort of a small version of them inside your heart, like sort of inside the heart chakra, sitting there, if you want. So the idea, of course, of dissolving that is to sort of merge your mind with the guru and to really uplift the mind, to be really uplifted and joyous. So that's the purpose of this visualization of dissolving the guru into ourself. And so then at that point, we are now ready to meditate. We've done all the preparations and the mind should be in the optimal positive state to now do the meditation. And of course, here we're talking about shamatha practice. So this is the 6 preparations. Any questions about any of this before we briefly start the actual practice? Yeah. Yeah.
Visualize something which is normally out of your sight. Because
out of?
I will explain. Visualization means you imagine something what you could see, like it's an image.
Yeah, like your teacher.
Yeah, for example. But I really can't imagine anything inside my body or on the top of my head or at the back. Because normally I can't see what is like on the top of my head with my eyes. So how would I just...
Yeah, but visualizing, we're not doing with our eyes, are we?
Yes,
we're doing with the mind.
Yes, but naturally it's not really possible to imagine. Like,
you can't. You could never imagine anything on the top of your head. Not possible. You can't imagine something being behind you. Like, if you're looking at me, could you imagine someone standing behind you?
I can't have an idea of someone is standing, but it's not a visualization. Because,
it's not?
As an artist, I can visualize pretty well. I can imagine different pictures. But it's
perfect.
Like, but it's like before me.
Ah.
It's,
so you have...
Yeah. I can imagine maybe any picture.
You can.
But I can't imagine picture behind me or on top of me or inside my body. Like, I don't know, picture.
Yeah.
And the reality of the body is the reality of the body. I never seen something inside me.
So you couldn't imagine a picture behind you on the wall. If you have an imagine a picture you're going to draw, you couldn't imagine it being on the wall behind you.
For example, I could know that behind me there is like a red brick wall, and there is a picture.
No, we're talking.
When I will imagine that, I will just imagine a red brick wall with a picture. But not
so let's say. Let's say you're going to draw a picture, and you can clearly see what the picture is going to be. Okay?
Yes.
Can you imagine that on the wall of your apartment?
Yes.
Is your apartment in front of your eyes now? Maybe in another country.
Somewhere.
Yeah, so it's not in front of your eyes. So there you go. You've imagined something that's not in front of your eyes. Right. So the important thing with this visualization is to not have a clear visual idea of a guru in here. The important thing is to imagine that your mind in them has merged, that you have connection with the teacher. That's what's important. So what's important is to have the felt sense of the presence of the teacher rather than having a clear picture of a teacher in miniature here. So that the important thing is the sense of connection, presence, not whether or not they're clear or they're this big or something. That's not so important. So if you can't do that, that's okay. It doesn't matter. What's important... Okay, then forget about it. Then don't worry. You don't need to do it. The important thing is to feel the presence of the teacher. Whether or not they happen to be a little here or not doesn't matter. The important thing is the presence. So then, fine, no problem. Okay, let's just briefly move on and to start the next bit. So we're now down to the actual practice. And of course, here the actual practice is the actual shamatha practice. So let's just look at the first point. It says, the concentration to be accomplished here is a concentration possessing two aspects, vivid clarity and a non-discursive single-pointedness. So these are the two qualities that we are cultivating in this shamatha practice. So when it says non-discursive single-pointedness, it means that we can single-pointedly focus without any discursive things going on, without any other activities going on. So what we're really talking about there is the quality of stability, stable attention. And the other one here is vivid clarity. So we want a stable mind, meaning to be able to single-pointedly focus on a given object, but also we want to be able to focus on that in a very clear way, with vivid clarity. Of course, what is stopping us from having this single-pointed attention is distraction, discursiveness, distraction. And here in the shamatha practice, this is normally listed as excitement. Because the most common form of distraction is that we're distracted by something pleasant, the so-called sense pleasures. So often the word distraction here, the word that's used here is excitement. And then what is stopping clarity, what's stopping us from focusing clearly, of course, is dullness. And the technical word is laxity. Laxity. Here, I like to add a third quality that's not mentioned here in these sorts of texts normally. And I think it's something that I've already emphasized a little bit already. And it's something that we really need to pay attention to in our practice. And that, of course, is relaxation. Because we tend to come into meditation quite agitated, a lot of stress in our lives, our minds tend to be very chaotic, and as I've already mentioned a couple of times, I think, is that when we focus in our daily life, because our minds are so chaotic, we naturally tense to focus, to be able to hold the object so that we don't get distracted. That's our default mode of focus, is with tension, even to the point where we often hold our breath. And if we only need to focus for a short time, that can sort of work. But we know from our own experience, if we focus with tension longer time, often we become completely exhausted and often become very agitated. So of course here, this is not the approach we want to follow. So we need to reprogram ourselves a little bit in how we focus. Now in our life, we're either focused and tense, or we're relaxed and half asleep. So we need to combine the focus and the relaxation. So we need to learn how to relax, to overcome tension, and then on that basis, we can develop stability and clarity. So then we can focus in a very stable and clear way on the basis of relaxation. So we need to really work on these qualities in this order. It's very important. So this is what's being said here in that first sentence. Any questions? Yeah.
By saying relaxation, we are talking about the mind.
Both the body and the mind, because they're very closely interrelated.
Yeah, but when we're talking about both, with the relaxation, I'm relaxing, but losing the posture.
Losing the posture.
Meditation.
Right. So that's why if we set ourselves up in a good posture, then that won't happen.
Yeah, relax, relax.
Right.
Relaxing.
Right. But that's why if we have a good posture and the back is straight, when we relax, we don't collapse. If our back is not straight and we relax, of course we're going to go like this. But if our back is straight, I mean, if something's straight and it relaxes, it won't sort of fall over, will it? It'll just sit down.
So at least you shouldn't be losing that straightness.
Yeah, so if we find that when we're relaxing, we're collapsing, we need to adjust our posture so that the back is straight. Because otherwise, if it's not straight, then of course to hold it there, we need tension, don't we? And if we release that tension, we'll just go like this. So, yeah, so if you find you're doing that, then we need to adjust the posture so that the back is naturally straight. So when it relaxes, it just sits down. So that's why one of the reasons a good posture is important. Yeah.
When you relax, probably you might get sleepy, like dullness might come quite often, or distraction and dullness. There are two extremes that are always kind of between the two, but never in the middle.
Yeah. So again, now when we're alert, we're tense, and when we relax, we become dull. So when we're cultivating the relaxation here at the beginning, we're not allowing the mind to become more dull than it is. Maybe it's not super clear, but whatever level of clarity we have, we try to maintain that as we relax and not just allow relaxation to sink into dullness. And then, of course, you're right, these are the two main imbalances, and we tend to flip between them. And it's not so easy to resolve. In fact, we will see that in the text coming up. Just to read on it, on page 6 at the top is quoting a great Indian master, Chandra Goman, who says, "If I rely upon exertion, excitement will arise. And if I give it up, laxity will occur. Since it is difficult to find an appropriate balance, what should I do with my agitated mind?" So that's what we're going to see, is that even for quite advanced shamatha practitioners, this is still a challenge, to find that balance in the middle. When we really do find it, then we've got shamatha. So of course now our extremes are quite big, and as we move, then the extremes will be flipping, but it'll be less and less. It won't be like we're not going to be falling asleep, we're not going to be completely lost in something. The imbalances will become less and less severe, but then finally then gone. Okay, then it's dinner time now, so let's stop there. We'll continue on that tomorrow. So this evening, of course, we're going to continue the compassion wing of the practice. And this evening, actually, we're going to do a actual compassion meditation. And then I want to talk a little bit about compassion that may be helpful. And then tomorrow morning in our shamatha practice, now that we've had 2 days of breath work, hopefully we've settled down a little bit, because tomorrow morning we're going to move into the mahamudra practice of observing the mind in the shamatha practice. And similarly in the afternoon, now we've done vipassana practice using the body as a basis, tomorrow we're going to start vipassana practice using the mind. So slowly, slowly you're moving into it. So that's the program for tomorrow. So let's take a break and come back at 7:30.